Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. Today is Sunday, August 28th, 2016. The share ID for Friday, August 26th, is 9030. This morning, A Vision for You presents a practical program of action. Enthusiasm is common, but endurance is rare. The 12 steps, as outlined in the Big Book, represent a process of spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. The Big Book was written as a set of directions for doing the steps quickly and effectively. It's not a book of theory or philosophy. It offers a clear step-by-step approach for your recovery. Most of us have come to Overeaters Anonymous as a result of the hopelessness, frustration, and despair we experience in our disease of compulsive overeating. We come to OA looking for a way out, a solution which will free us from the bondage, pain, and suffering of our affliction. OA stands for the proposition that the 12 steps give us freedom from the bondage of food and the bondage of self. However, this is not a quick fix. Simple, but not easy. Recovery is not an overnight matter. The exciting thing about the 12 steps is that they teach us how to live. Once we know the design of living and the principles of living a successful life, we find that we not only get over the problems we see, but we avoid many other problems we would have had. The miracle is that all of this was boiled down into 12 simple steps which anybody can apply. Joining us today to speak on this topic is Larry Kay, a beloved recovered compulsive overeater from Chicago, Illinois. Larry is committed to the 12-step way of life and to guiding and teaching others how to do the same. Welcome to the line, Larry. Star one to unmute.
Got it. Good morning, Leah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thanks for the getting us started and for your service. So, yeah, I like what Leah shared there, you know, just as kind of a precursor to what I was going to talk about this morning. So I'm Larry Kay. I'm a recovered compulsive reader from the Chicago area. And I'm happy to report that I have not found it necessary to consume any of my binge substances since having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, and that happened a number of years ago. But I'd like to tell you, I came in and I wandered into these rooms, and then boom, you know, I just embarked on these steps right away. You know, I was desperate and I was ready, and you know, and the rest is history. And that's just not my experience. You know, maybe yours is different, but I'll tell you a little bit about mine. I am down about, approximately 100 pounds from my highest weight when I got here. I'm about 5'10", 170 pounds. I only, you know, pretty much weighed myself, you know, perhaps once a month or so. It definitely, when I got here, you know, my problem, or so I thought, was weight and was food. That was my problem. Of course, I felt that I knew exactly what my problem was, and you know, it seemed to me that there were some other people in OA that had a similar problem, and some of them seemed to have changed. And mostly what I was paying attention to was their physical changes. And those physical changes attracted me first, and you know, over time, you know, I learned other things about this process of change and about the actions that they took and about, you know, the manner that they were living now. Here's something else that I'll tell you. I'm also happy to report to you that despite lots of calamity that has come in my life from time to time, because hey, let's face it, life is going to happen. You know, one of the things you may hear in programs is, you know, life happens on life's terms. And yes, that is indeed true. My, you know, the things that go on in my life today, the things that come, they you know, there are challenges. There's death, there's sickness, there's illness. But I, one thing that I'm happy to report is that despite the calamity that comes my way, since the time that I received this gift of freedom as a result of this practical program of action, we hear it time and time again, despite that, I've been happy, joyous, and free. I have been happy, joyous, and free. I'm not sober today, abstinent today, but miserable, you know, wishing, you know, battling with the food and the substances and all those behaviors. I'm no longer battling with that. That's one of the promises that we read about, that the problem will be solved, and it has for me today by the grace of God. And so with God's grace, you know, I have the opportunity, hopefully, to be of service to you this morning. You know, that's my wish. You know, I pray that the God of my understanding will help me to be of maximum service to this God and to those about me. And that's how I try my best to live my life today. So, you know, the presentation, if you will, this morning is, yes, enthusiasm is common, yet endurance is rare. And that for sure was my experience coming in here. And I see that in others, that it seems to me that a lot of people come into this program with a great deal of enthusiasm. You know, in the field of education, which I'm a part of, it's one of the things that I do, you know, we've learned that research has shown us that among students, IQ is not the only difference between the best and worst students. You know, some of the very, probably isn't surprising to you that some of the very best performers, the best students, did not have necessarily stratospheric IQ scores. And conversely, some of the smartest students, in terms of let's say IQ, they don't perform so well in school. And, you know, it turns out that perhaps the greatest predictor of success in a whole variety of endeavors isn't IQ. And it isn't, I'll tell you that it isn't social intelligence, and it's certainly not good looks, nor is it even being raised by two parents, although some of those things, you know, can be helpful. No, it was something that we call grit. And grit, what we've come to learn is, and I want to mention this because that is part of the topic, is what it's going to take in this program, at least in my experience. Grit is passion and perseverance for in this pursuit, this long-term lifetime goal. Grit is having stamina in the face of struggle, and it's sticking with the future day in and day out. You know, we hear one day at a time, not just for the week, not just for the month, but for years, for a lifetime. Grit is about survival in the face of calamity and challenge. And based on my experience, you know, I would suggest to you, with this program, because that's what we're talking about, with this program in mind, I would suggest to you that grit is most certainly intertwined with this movement from a self-centered existence to a God-centered existence, however you define the God of your own understanding. That somehow the grit that's required is intertwined with that movement. It certainly was for me, and it continues to unfold. And grit is living life more like it's a marathon. That's what this program is. It is, you know, I've heard Leah and I've heard other people share, which is a sentiment that I really agree with, that captures it, that program, you know, is no longer something that I just do to get an effect, to get a result that I, from this seemingly, you know, we hear this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Program is no longer something that I do, but it really is. Program is something that I am. It is embedded in the very fabric of who I am. And, you know, in trying to be of service to you this morning, you know, obviously I'm devoted. The big book and the text, our text, is what got me well. That's part of my story. It's unequivocally part of my story. The text precisely is what got me well. And so for me to carry a message, you know, to try to be of service to you, is I'm going to focus on perhaps helping you to gain more clarity, as others helped me to gain more clarity, around three really critical concepts. And they're not Larry's concepts, trust me. Because Larry's concepts almost got me killed. I assure you it'll get you killed. So I'm not going to be offering Larry's opinions, although I have opinions, and I'd be happy to share with you my opinions. Addicts have opinions. I'm sure you have yours, I have mine. And sometimes they could be good opinions. But what I'm going to share with you this morning is the facts as laid out in this text, because that's what got me well. And, you know, these three critical concepts, the first concept is around this alcoholic mind associated with the compulsive overeater, what it is, and getting the opportunity to diagnose yourself. You know, do you have this problem? What's wrong with you? And is what's wrong with you this alcoholic mind? Because it was for me, no question. So the first concept can be boiled down to, you know, what's the problem? Because, you know, you may have heard it said, I have, if you don't know what the problem is, you know, sort of any solution that you happen to find, and I search for them all, is going to get you there if you really don't know what the problem is. You need to know what the problem is. So what is the problem? And the second concept is, you know, what's the solution to this problem? And the third concept is, how in the world are we going to bring this solution to light? How do you make that solution happen? Which, of course, is deliberate action. So, and these are the three things you're going to need for recovery. And quite frankly, those are the three things that anybody in the world needs to solve any problem. What is the problem? What is the solution to that problem? And how do we bring that solution to light? And now, because there's been an unbelievable watering down of our basic message over the course of time that AA and OA has been in existence, you know, there has leaked into our rooms an immense amount of misinformation surrounding these three essential concepts: the problem, the solution to the problem, and how in the world are you going to bring that solution to light? And, you know, if you're going to apply grit to this program, we're going to need to drill down to just what those are. And that misinformation that is in the rooms, and I don't speak disparagingly, my goodness, I love Overeaters Anonymous. I'll go to any meeting, anytime, in Overeaters Anonymous, by phone, in person, love it, okay? But that misinformation, that erroneous information, considering that we're dealing with a life and death proposition here, right? We're not playing here. This is a life or death proposition. I'm sure, statistically speaking, that there may be someone on the line that's dying right now. You may not have taken your last breath yet. There's that death, but you're the walking dead, and I know exactly what that feels like. And you know, I know that I will die someday, as we all will. But I don't want to die of this disease. And as long as I stay on this beam of recovery, which isn't hard, that I won't. So this misinformation, this erroneous information, considering again that we're dealing with this life and death problem, when it comes to compulsive overeating and other addictions, that erroneous information, see, it serves to do more than just be a detriment to you. Frankly, it may serve in killing you. It's deadly information. That's the problem. It's deadly information. And therefore, it stands to reason that it's integral that we understand the facts. You know, what the program of action is, what it isn't. And I want to be clear, when I say the facts, I'm not talking about my opinion. Because like you, you know, as I said, I have lots of opinions, and, you know, I can share those with you. But here's the thing. My opinions will not get you well. My opinions will not get you well. They didn't get me well. Nobody's opinions will get you well. And quite frankly, as I mentioned, the opinions of addicts are not particularly hard to come by. You can go to bars and bakeries for that. But the idea of the rooms is not for you to get people's opinions. With that said, you know, you're going to find OA littered with people who will these days will give you opinions and frame them as facts. And we hear it all the time. And that is going to be very dangerous for someone who is a real compulsive overeater like me. You know, so, and we've heard different things, and they're well-intentioned things, you know. But how in the world, you know, one or two, if you get these opinions framed as facts, something that is not in the precise text and is not congruent with the precise text that gets people well, that's been getting people well since it was published, largely unchanged since 1939. You know, and you hear these things framed as facts. Like one of the things that I heard, you know, keep coming back, you know, sort of wait for the miracle to happen. And so I did. So I did. Because people, loving people, with some with authority, some who had been sober for a long period of time. They were in, an attractive body, which I wanted. They seemed to speak with authority. Keep coming back, Larry. Just keep coming back. Wait for the miracle to happen. You know, and they said it with great enthusiasm and great intent. And so I did. I kept coming back. And I thought I had to work this harder. And I had to read this more diligently. That there was, see, over time, something happens. And it happens to any human being. If you're getting erroneous information, however well-intentioned, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to get to the point where you just, over and over again, as I did, I don't care how disciplined you are, you're going to get to a point where you say, you know, I really suck at this. I'm really, really bad at this. I'm already feeling bad about myself. I can't stay out of the food, but I'm really bad at this. And some people will go away, and I've seen many. And if you've been around for a while, you've seen many. They've come to you with great enthusiasm, not necessarily, the ability to endure, but they're getting this information and they come with great enthusiasm. But if you continue to hear things like that or some sort of magic associated with the tools, and I'm not here to disparage OA and I'm not here to talk about, in any sort of derogatory fashion about the tools. The tools are essential. The tools are essential. I'm using them now. You know, we're using them now. We're on the phone. You know, I'm going to be, talking a little bit about our literature. You know, I'm doing service. They're all tools and they're good and they're critical. But they were not designed. If there's one thing that sticks with you, please remember the tools. I wish someone would have told me, Larry, the tools are not designed to get you well. The tools are designed to support you while you get well. What's going to get you well, my friend? And see, you can't deliver this message unless it happened to you. You can't in good faith deliver it unless it happened to you. But it's happened to me by the grace of God. And I can tell you, you know what? The tools, I don't care your IQ. I don't care what your background is. The tools are not going to get you well. What's going to get you well is following the directions in the text in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous precisely. You couldn't do it perfectly if you tried. So you might as well give up on that. But if you follow it precisely, and you better do it quickly because the race is on. I hope you didn't hear me say, do it, just go through it half-assed. That's not what I said. But you better do it quickly because there is a race. Because you need, because that, as long as that obsession of the mind is alive and well, oh, it's not if you're going to pick up. Oh, you're going to pick up. It's really a matter of when. See, we do need to apply ourselves quickly. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But the thing is that, this... So what I'm going to concentrate again is the facts as laid out in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, we hear it again and again. That is our basic text. And by doing so, my hope is that you can transition quickly from enthusiasm for this solution to the enduring walk day by day as a recovered compulsive overeater, where you're not in battle with the obsession every day, where you've experienced a spiritual transformation of change as a result of subjecting yourself to the steps as instructed in the Big Book, and you experience this day by day change. If you have a white light experience, wonderful. Congratulations, that's great. I didn't. Mine, they talk about it in the Big Book. They talk about it in the appendix about the spiritual awakening as the spiritual experience as more of the educational variety. That encapsulates what I experienced, more of the educational variety. But when it happened, while there wasn't some white light epiphany, light bulb above my head, got it, come to my graduation, everyone. No, there wasn't that. Somehow I knew. I knew, and maybe with a little bit of trepidation and hesitation, perhaps the God of my understanding, there was some confidence built in that approach, and I began to carry the message first with a little bit of trepidation, and over time, it just has evolved for me, and it continues to unfold and evolve. I don't believe the God of my understanding is through with me yet. I sure hope not. I don't think so. That's not the evidence that I'm presented with in this life. So somehow 10, 11, and 12, we hear people talking in code about living in 10, 11, and 12. By the way, there's some precise instructions about that as well in our big book. But it's not hard. It's not terribly hard to trudge this road of happy destiny. It's not. It really isn't. So this brings us squarely back to again, you know, the presentation topic. Enthusiasm is common. Endurance is rare. You know, when one is drowning, you know, think of someone literally drowning. I don't know if anyone's had that experience. I hope not. But that level of desperation, right, to say that this person is enthusiastic for a possible solution to their problem of death is perhaps an understatement. You know, you come to the party eager, fervent, perhaps a glimmer of hope to find a solution. And, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting to me. The instinct not to breathe underwater is so strong that it overcomes the agony of running out of air. No matter how desperate the drowning person is, he doesn't inhale until he's on the verge of losing consciousness. When you hear of talking about drowning, I've read about it, I've studied about the psychology of those types. I mean, that's a level of desperation, right? There's a gift of desperation there. At that point, there's so much carbon dioxide in the person's blood and so little oxygen. There's kind of a chemical sensors in the brain that trigger an involuntary breath whether he's underwater or not. And they call that the break point. And there's tons of laboratory experiments that have shown the break point to come at about 87 seconds, more than you ever wanted to hear about the notion of drowning. But let's bring it to reality. It's sort of a neurological optimism, as if the body were saying, you know, holding our breath is killing us, and breathing in might not kill us, so we might as well breathe in. And this process is filled with desperation and awkwardness. So, you know, I've read, you know, people experience, so this is drowning, a drowning person might think. So this is how my life finally ends. Needless to say, when a drowning person gets to OA, using that metaphor, you know, the gift of desperation has them eager for a solution. Yet, again, if a well-intentioned person throws the drowning person a beautiful, shiny, glorious rock rather than a rope in which to pull themselves to be saved from the water, a life preserver, it's not going to be long before the person will give up. You throw them an anchor, they're going down. I don't care how beautiful it is. And by way of contrast, I'd like to take a stroll with you back to our, you know, for our purposes, say to 1947. I don't know how I got from drowning to 1947, but come with me, okay? So you walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in 1947. You're sick and suffering. You're dying from untreated alcoholism. And you stroll in for the first time, and here's basically what you could have expected to happen. First, when you come in 1947, and I've studied a little bit. I wasn't there, but I've studied. You would have been welcomed upon entering. You probably would have been embraced upon entering. You would have been likely introduced to all the members of that respective group. And then you know what they would have done? They would have assigned you a sharing partner. So you would have been linked up with somebody. You know, a sharing partner, by the way, means the exact same thing as a sponsor. We didn't have the same terminology back then, and that's why you won't see the word sponsor appearing in the big book. But, you know, this whole notion of searching out somebody, it didn't exist then. They would have linked you up with a sharing partner. And that sharing partner would have sat you down and essentially would have told you the following. You know, he or she would have told you, look, I'm going to be your advocate over the course of say, 4 sessions here. It's going to take place over the course of 4 weeks for about 1 hour per week. And what's going to happen tonight is we're going to go over the first 3 steps. So tonight, you're going to find out what's wrong with you in step 1. You're going to find out with the solution to what's wrong with you in step two. And you know what you're gonna make, if you so choose, you're gonna make an affirmative declaration in step three based on your understanding of the problem and the solution to your problem, that you're ready to get to work. And then if you decide to come back next week, assuming you come back, we're gonna go over steps four and five. We're gonna talk about a searching and fearless moral inventory. And that following week you complete your inventory. You know, they're not messing around here. And then you and I are going to sit down and you'll complete step five with me. And then when you come back the following week, we're going to go over steps six, seven, eight, and nine. And you'll do your eight-step list, and you'll begin doing your ninth step. You'll begin making your ninth-step amends. And when you come back during that following week, week four, you'll begin to practice steps 10, 11, and 12, at which point you're going to be a recovered alcoholic. And you're gonna learn how to maintenance and grow what you've been given by the program of recovery, and then naturally you'll become a sharing partner for others. And of course, you know, at that point in the discussion, you had the opportunity to stay for that meeting that evening to begin the process, or you might run like hell and go back to the disease, and the disease is waiting for you. It's there. Go back to door number two. It's always there. And it's certainly your choice, right? And, you know, that was unequivocally what was going on, from my understanding, from what I, you know, I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but from what I can gather, that was unequivocally what was going on for the first quarter century of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the first 20 to 25 years of AA, that's how this message was essentially carried to suffering alcoholics. Now, I wonder why someone in this program probably doesn't even remember. Some guy told me, go to an AA meeting. Not that there's any magic in an AA meeting, but he said, you know what? They work the steps. Find yourself a good AA meeting. Of course, well, I'm not an alcoholic. Why don't I find an AA meeting? Of course, I was calling this guy because, you know, nothing was changing. Nothing was changing, and I'm working this OA program harder. Nothing's changing. He says, go find yourself an AA meeting. Huh, well, that was good advice. That was some of the best advice I got. This is the first 20 to 25 years of AA. That's how this message was carried to suffering alcoholics. That's how this message was developed and put together by our pioneers and by our co-founders, which is another way of saying that's how it was intended to be done. That's how it has to be done. That's how it was meant to, it's not how it has to be done, but that's how it was meant to be done. Now, let's cut to 2016. Here we are, towards the end of August 2016. I don't know how you got here. You might have just kind of strolled on this line here. Here you are. You're a sick and suffering compulsive overeater. You may be dying from this untreated disease. Maybe you wander into an OA meeting for the first time. You may or may not be welcomed, depending on the meeting. They may or may not realize you're a new person. They may have a newcomer greeter. They may not. There may be no one looking out for such a thing, for new people. There's a very decent chance you may come into the room like I did, find a seat in the back. I don't want to run into anybody, and have no idea what the hell is going on. I don't know if that was your experience. By the way, very beautiful, wonderful people, well-intentioned people in Overeaters Anonymous, right? But depending on what kind of meeting it is, and considering that topic and discussion meetings outnumber literature meetings, i.e. big book studies, you get on Vision for You, we study one or two paragraphs at a time of Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, depending on where you... I think it's like 7-1 in terms of these topic and discussion meetings, outnumbering literature meetings. Chances are you're going to hear someone's story, which may or may not resonate with you. And depending on the meeting, they may talk about the 12 steps, or you may hear nothing about the 12 steps, really. Depending upon the meeting, they may talk about sponsorship. They may not talk about sponsorship. If they do talk about sponsorship, you you may start the process of wandering around looking for a sponsor. Who knows how long that's going to take? And when you eventually find a sponsor, it's very possible that the sponsor will tell you that the 12 steps, which can save your life, will take upwards of a year or more to work, during which time there's a very good chance you may relapse or die. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's what's going on in every OA meeting, because you may be like, that's not what's going on in my meeting. But I'm definitely suggesting that's what's going on in most of them these days. I've been to a few. So over the course of those first 25 years in our AA history, you know, we maintained an astonishing rate of recovery. In the last 25 to 30 years, the rate of recovery, not so good. It's gone into the dumper. In OA, not so good in terms of our recovery rates. Recidivism, relapse, unfortunately, becomes the norm. Again, well-intentioned, beautiful people, of course. But it's amazing if we can pull, you know, a 5% rate of recovery in OA in a given year. That would be phenomenal. We're killing more people than we're saving. It's troubling indeed. But what a great opportunity too, right? It's troubling indeed. You know, Vision for You, which I love, you know, it's a great, wonderful thing. It's very attractive to some people. They're hearing something different. We're just a bunch of people that are working the big book to the best of our ability. We're trying to learn from each other. I get the opportunity to get on the line and learn, you know, from other people, get their insights, their experience. But we, you know, let's be clear, we're studying the precise instructions in the text, and we're talking about application and deliberate action. If you're not hearing deliberate action, if you're coming to get entertained, I mean, you might get entertained here and there, but you may die while being entertained. So the idea of a back to basics kind of meeting, or the intense study of this practical program of action, you know, with enthusiasm, which we many of us come here with, is important. You know, it's very important so you can engage in the process of getting well expeditiously. You know, on Roman numeral 13 in the fourth edition of the big book, in the foreword to the first edition, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous. Notice the very first word is we. This is indeed a we program, not an I program. I can't get well. I can't get sober, get abstinent, but we can. We can. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, not our recovering, have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So the state of mind and body wasn't hopeless after all. It was only seemingly hopeless. It's never been hopeless. So up until this book got published, people like you and I, we were doomed, screwed, you know. Now listen closely to this. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So this book, our basic text, the main purpose, the very reason for its existence, the reason they wrote this book is to explain to you, the person just wandering in 2016, precisely how they have recovered. And they are not using that word lightly. Not almost how we recovered. Let me tell you how we almost recovered till we fell flat in our face and they buried us 6 feet under. No, how we recovered. We're not going to give you a vague idea of how we recovered and you sort of, you know, work your own program according to which way the wind's blowing. I mean, you can do that if you wish to. But the idea of writing the book was that after hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years of there being no solution for people like us, they found one. They found one. They knew what they had was unbelievably valuable. They realized that when worked precisely the way it's laid out in our text, it worked every time. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I tell people, I've never seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed the path. I didn't say perfectly followed the path, but thoroughly followed the path. Never seen that. if you worked it. And they wanted to preserve that, these pioneers. They wanted to preserve that, and they, you know, they realized, wow, if we don't put this down on paper, you know, sooner or later when we, because there was about 100 of them, approximately 100 of them at the time, a little less, who conspired in writing this book, when we're all dead, you know, 100 or 200 years down the road, this thing could get really watered down. People could really lose sight of what the message is. So let's get all this down on paper. Let's offer precise instructions. Now, here's an opinion of mine. In my opinion, that's a divine message of hope. I think it was God-inspired. There's my opinion. I don't speak for anyone but me. I think it was a divine message of hope through deliberate action. And let's face it, we butchered it anyway. So God knows, you know, what would have happened had they not put it down on paper. That's why they put it down on paper, so that you and I would know exactly how they did it. You don't have to come up with any solutions on your own. If something doesn't coincide with what's in the big book, I wouldn't do it. Run in the other direction. Let's do it exactly the same way and get it right. Now, for the message to get out, we created this fellowship. We organized. And frankly, we needed to organize. If we hadn't organized, it would still be, maybe five guys smoking cigars in Akron. So we needed to do this for the message to spread. And unfortunately, oftentimes with organization comes a watering down of quality. Now, I don't know about you, but have you ever played the game telephone? I'm guessing you have. If we were actually going to play the game of telephone, I'd whisper a secret to Leia. Leia, you know, would share it with someone else. Eventually, that secret message would make itself around the room from one person to another. And finally, in the game of telephone, the last person receiving the secret message, started from me to Leia, they read it, they share it aloud. And what would happen to that message? Well, the nature of the game is that the original message will have changed. It may be a little bit different, or it may be, you know, remarkably different, but it will change. So ask yourself, what's happened over the course of 80-some years? Hundreds of thousands of AA rooms, later OA rooms, millions of addicts. We love our opinions. They're like noses. I got quite a nose, schnoz on me. Millions of addicts, many of whom, let's face it, they like to hear the sound of their own voice. a lot of information has come into the rooms that is markedly different from what's in the big book. And what's in the big book is, you know, this isn't a bunch of random facts. These are directions on how to save your life. You know, maybe we've lost our way, so we need to get back to basics here. We've done, in some ways a disservice to people by taking a simple program, a simple practical program of action, and embedding it with confusion, complexity, and sometimes subterfuge. I don't even know what that means, but, you know, some trickery here, there, you know, indeed we have. And whenever I speak to anybody about the practical program of action today, in the first 164 pages of our text, I try to speak my truth as I've experienced it and as I has been passed down to me and as I continue to experience it. Because today, getting back to, you know, enthusiasm is common, endurance is rare. I get, you know, I'm out there, you know, there's a lot of ladies out there, not as many male voices. We're out there, us guys, we're out there, you know, but we can get intimidated and we're already socialized to just do it and fix it and solve the problem yourself, but we're out there. But, you know, so I get it because I'm out there. I get to talk to people in pain, physical and emotional pain, will occasionally reach out to me as they probably do to you. And there's a desperation in their voice. I hear you. I remember what that feels like. There's a desperation in your voice and your demeanor. And some of you are severely overweight. Others of you are severely underweight. You know, others perhaps have only experienced moderate physical consequences thus far. Some, sad to say, may be suicidal. Others are seemingly normal in every respect. We always want to think we're kind of normal, right? So we'll say, yeah, you're one of those people. You're normal in every respect. Perhaps they're like I was when I first arrived here, dabbling in Overeaters Anonymous. Dabbling, kind of the way you know, kind of the way one commonly gravitates towards the self-help section at your local bookstore or your library. Have you done that? I've done that. You know, kind of gravitate over there. So while I've seen people with varying levels of desperation for this solution over the years, here's something that then any recovered compulsive overeater who's intent on carrying this message, the message of hope in this book, yes, enthusiasm is common for starters, yet endurance is rare. So, you know, it does take that grit that I was talking about, and it doesn't require a high IQ, nor does it require a commitment to blissful ignorance. It's simply going to take a degree of perseverance and passion as we trudge this precise road of action towards this happy destiny. It culminates in getting a promised result. And I want to tell you that promised revolt, there's some of that too, result defies science. This program, you may hear, this program is not about science. I'm a lover of science, but I tell you it's not about science. This program defies our best intuition. See, the brain of mine, you know, that's been trained as yours has been trained. I've been to university. You know, this brain that I thought, this magnificent brain. Well, this brain convinced me to eat massive quantities of food in a darkened room day after miserable day. Don't think you're terminally unique. We're the same. You know, hoping against hope that I would stick to another cabbage soup diet. I bought a lot of cabbage. Or this brain of mine convinced me that liposuction surgery was the answer, not once, but twice. It was not. That wonderful brain, it led me to seek out, drugs to suppress my appetite. I think these folks in the Congo, I was convinced, came up with they had the solution to suppress my appetite. That was it. That was where my brain led me, my thinking. That was my best thinking, this brain of mine. My brain, I couldn't get home from work in the evening where I was teaching and shaping minds, right? This brain of mine would not allow me to get home from work in the evening without stopping for some of my heroin at a drive-thru window. This went on for decades, 2 decades to be precise. You know, it may go against what you learned as a child. Here's the message I learned. Just do it, Larry. You're the master of your destiny, my friend. Seize the day. So I walk in here and at some point learn that, oh, I don't know, Larry, how about you turn your will and your life over to the God of your understanding? What, are you kidding me? I'll take the wheel. Thank you very much. See, in fact, I had no experiential evidence to suggest this spiritual approach would work. You know, I was always a math avoider. All my life I was a math avoider. In mathematics, you know, from what I understand, a proof, this you know, having some sort of deductive argument for a mathematical statement, and you know, you have theorems, and you know, in principle, a proof can be traced back to self-evident or assumed statements known as axioms, and blah blah blah, right? And I believe in scientific methodology. You know, the scientific method is a process for experimentation that we use to explore observations and answer questions. But even when modified, you know, the goal remains the same, to discover cause and effect relationships by asking these questions, carefully gathering the evidence and examining that evidence. You know, I thought I was so smart. I knew all about these processes. Seeing if all the available information can be combined into a logical answer, I felt very comfortable in that world. But all I can tell you about my personal experience with this program is it works. I can't prove to you why it works. Nor, frankly, do I have any desire to convince you of its efficacy. My only wish is to be of maximum service to God and to those about me. You know, on page 25 in the big book, I'm checking my time here, Leah. On page 25 in the big book, the chapter appropriately entitled, There Is a Solution. Huh, imagine that. We're reminded there is a solution. But almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation. I didn't like that. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we've come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. You know, there is a solution. I didn't, self-searching, leveling of our pride, give me a food plan, Mr. Thin Guy. I want to know what you eat. I'm going to eat what you eat. I swear, my first sponsor, he's up there talking in front of all these people, you know, and with such truth and honesty, and he's in a thin body, and I was just amazed at this guy. I was amazed by this guy. And the stuff that he had been through in his life, he and his wife had lost a child. And I had a young daughter. I couldn't imagine. You know, I thought if that ever happened to me, if I ever contemplated that, losing a child, I thought, well, I'm going to make a quick exit. Honestly, I couldn't imagine. And here I'm hearing someone that went through life on life's terms and got through it. And by the way, you know, and, you know, I mean, his family, I mean, they, you know, they don't have a program. He has a program. He has a design for living that works for him. They don't. So one of the first things I did is I wanted to know more about this guy. But frankly, I wanted to, my scientific mind told me, we'll just do what he does. Well, I didn't really want that. I didn't really like the notion of self-searching. The leveling of my pride. I'm Larry. Leveling of my pride. Confession of shortcomings. Who the heck knows what that is? We'll get to that. Let me get rid of this weight first and this obsession that you talk about. I get that. Yeah, let me get rid of that first. Then I'll do some of this other fun stuff. You betcha. Take it away first, Daddy. Daddy, take away the suffering first. Then I'll make time for all this. I wanted what I wanted. Hey, would you send me your food plan? Would you? Would you do that for me? Guess what, Larry? You're not gonna be able to follow his food plan. There's some work to be done, my friend. Yes, you're gonna have to put down your heroin. Not about a diet. You couldn't follow his food plan if you tried. You couldn't follow anyone's food plan. Your problem, the main problem, centered in between your ears and your mind, Larry. You might have an allergy of the body, right? We learn in the doctor's opinion about the allergy of the body. But you got a far worse problem, Buster Brown. You got an obsession of the mind that's going to lead you back again and again and again to that syringe. Oh, you think your food, it's not like a heroin addict? Think again. If you're like me. You think you'll win out on the disease? You think you're going to get the right food plan? You couldn't try my food plan. There's no way. I couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. You have to put the food down and be willing to go through that uncomfortability and then embark on a precise program of action that leads to a change in fundamentally who you are. Because you couldn't deal with life on life's terms. You couldn't deal with the emotions. It was too much for you, my friend. You needed a power greater than yourself. You can't understand it. You can't rationalize it. You can try to reason it and think it, and you could try to build proof that it's going to work for you before you embark upon it, because I don't want to try anything until I know. I want a crystal ball program. Give me the celebrity sponsor. Give me a crystal ball so that I know exactly how this fairy tale ends. Then I'll do it. Oh, Larry, it doesn't work that way. Oh, no, it doesn't work that way. You're going to have to engage in this. Yes, you're going to have to put your heroin down, and then you're going to have to engage in this process of change, the self-searching, leveling of your pride. See, because it's not just doing the steps as if it's like magic. There's going to have to be, with each sequential step, you are going to go through a process of change, fundamentally who you are from the ground up. And only through that process of change that you can't effectuate that yourself. You think you can job this program, buddy boy? Think again. It's not going to work for you. You're going to experience a change that the God of your understanding, whatever that is to you, is going to effectuate that change. You don't effectuate the change. You just chop your wood. each day. Oh yeah, the food has to be down. Yeah, yeah, right. You think you're gonna job the system here and just kind of play with your food? It doesn't work that way. But don't take my word for it. The disease will convince you, or it won't, or you'll die an early death, or you'll be like the Walking Dead. So this is what I what I realized in going through this, and I want to address we talk about, people ask me sometimes, you know, about this notion of being recovered, and which side of the recovering debate are you on? Well, that's like asking someone which side of the sun sets in the east, sun sets in the west debate. Which side of that are you on? We know where the sun sets. See, we hear again and again from the title page, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Roman numeral 13, I read, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. The man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. Page 20. We have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Further on, page 29. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we have recovered. I can go on and on, but I'll just do one more. Page 44 and 45. If a mere code of morals, Larry, or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. So, you know, there is no debate. There was always the twofold nature of the disease. I started talking about the problem. We need to know the solution to our problem, and we need to know the mechanism in which to bring that solution to light. Well, you know, I talk to people about the doctor's opinion. You know, we spend time in there because Dr. Silkworth laid out, he was in a great position to know exactly what the problem was, just didn't know what the solution was until Bill and then others began to experience the solution. The problem is the twofold nature of your illness. If you're like me, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And once we understand and really begin to internalize that whole issue with step one in terms of what our problem is, what our precise problem is, then in step two, we begin to slowly, for some of us, for me slowly, understand what the solution to our problem is. Coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. And then ultimately, then how is it that we bring that solution to light, having had a spiritual awakening? How do we bring that solution to light? Well, once we make that affirmative declaration in the third step, we make an affirmative declaration to move forward with the action steps, to move forward with the actions that will produce an essential psychic change in an individual that's willing, because you got to provide the willingness, that's willing to embark on that. When that essential change happens, then the obsession is lifted. And if you're going to wait around trying to analyze why it's lifted, when it gets lifted, under what scientific, you know, how do I square this? You may die in the process of that analysis. You might. So what I would suggest to anybody, you know, you can be too smart for this program. I hope that doesn't light up your brain. Yes, I can. Yes, I can, Larry. I'm glad you said that, my friend. Now, you can be too smart for this program, you know, in terms of paralysis. Trying to get all your ducks in a row, trying to analyze everything. It's not about science. It's not about science. I don't care what your IQ is. I don't care how magnificent you are in your career, in your life. I don't care what measures you have in societal terms of the success. You might have a beautiful home, a car, a loving partner, family, every bit of evidence that shows what a, you know, how magnificent your life is, other than the fact that you're dying in this disease. It doesn't matter. The point is we have to, and we don't have a monopoly on forming this aligned relationship with our higher power. But nonetheless, for me, as a compulsive overeater, someone with an alcoholic mind that clearly had to diagnose myself, and the Big Book tells us precisely how to do that. And once I'm convinced of that and I'm able to diagnose myself, I realize that regardless of what I think about it, how smart I may think I am, that at some point it took this process, this precise process that produced the essential psychic change, that changed me as a man. I've never been the same. Never been the same. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. And now all I get to do is have the opportunity to carry this message. What a beautiful, beautiful thing it is. Wow, I can go on and on, but you're probably tired of hearing me talk. Leah, I'm going to pass with that, and maybe we can open up some questions if that's okay.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Larry, for your presentation this morning. Thanks for sharing your personal experience and insights with all of us. Larry's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording. Stay tuned for that. And now we will open the floor for questions for Larry. You can do so by pressing star 1 to unmute and identify yourself, please.
This is Laura G. I have a question for Larry.
Hi, Laura. One moment. Anyone else?
Martha S.
Martha S. Who else?
Maureen M.
Maureen. Anyone else?
Hi, this is Holly from Holly S. from Texas.
Holly S.
South Florida.
I didn't catch Florida.
Maureen H.
Maureen H. Excellent. Let's stop there. So, Laura G., go right ahead with your question, please.
Thank you. Am I being heard?
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you. Larry, I was hoping you would touch on the okay, the question is, when you first came into program, I touched on it, as we all know, that obstinate and almost like feet in the sand behavior. If you could just touch on how long it took you. I know it's never ending until we die, I know that. But how long it took you to kind of like let off the brake just a little bit and start trusting and especially depend on the we, which is so overlooked, I think, in some of our you know, thinking like the we all over the book is about connecting. And so I know that's been a big process for me. Thank you. Okay.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for the question. You know, I'm asked that from time to time, you know. And sometimes I wonder, you know, what is it that the person, you know, because they're, I wanted to know that too. And I heard some people that, well, you know, some people get it right away. We hear people that share, you know, they've been in program for 10 and 20 and 30 years. It's like, oh, dear God, please let that not be me. I can tell you for me, I'll just share my own experience that, look, I came into program and it was approximately 5 years of just more suffering, mayhem, you know, tornado kind of existence where I was still roaring through people's lives. And, you know, I don't know that there's any, you know, that there's any, it's like, because I think what I wanted to know, and you may be different than me with regard to the question is, I wanted to, there was some degree of, wanted to compare a little bit, just to kind of see like, because I knew, you know, as I've been in program a year, I'm like, well, I see a lot of people not getting it. You know, you're fine. It's going to take, it's a process, Larry, you know. But if I could tell anybody, no matter how long you've been in program, that there isn't a precise prescription for what, you know, how we get to that level of desperation. Because here's one of the issues. One of the problems is if you're on this line, in my opinion, not this line this morning, but if you get the opportunity to hear some people on Vision, that's a miracle. That's a miracle. Because in my opinion, you're hearing, there's something very special about Vision and the people on Vision. You're hearing people, many people, not all people, but many people who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And one of the issues, though, is if you can, I started out by talking about, you know, the state of, my perception of the state of Overeaters Anonymous and 12-step programs in general that are not delivering this clear, precise message because of the watering down and the sort of the telephone game, you know, where it's a lot of, you know, information seeps in there. But in answer to your question, yeah, there was, it was about a 5-year struggle. I don't know if there was a tipping point at that point. I'd like to tell you that I was, not would like to tell you, but it would be kind of a clean thing if I can say, well, you know what, 5 years in, there I am again with my fist in a bakery box, as I heard Leah say, I like that, you know, and I'm in the fetal position in the corner of my room in tears, you know, and that was what it took. No, it really was not quite that eventful. You know, what does it take for us to get beaten into a state of reasonableness? You're lucky if you get beaten into a state of reasonableness and you're poised to move forward with these precise instructions. But that was part of my story. It was 5 years. I know others, you know, much longer. But what I'd love today is how can we shorten that process for people? If you're here, what a miracle. And if you can shorten that process by hearing a message of hope from people who have recovered, and they're telling you unequivocally that if you at any point, wherever you are, whatever you know, however long you've been around program, if you are willing, and only you can provide the willingness to subject yourself to this precise process, and you couldn't do it perfectly if you tried, so you might as well detach from that, but you follow it precisely, and you, of course, put your heroin down, right? That's a given. You will experience a change that rarely do we see a person fail who has thoroughly followed this path. But for me, that's what it was. I don't think there was any magic in that period of time or any great epiphany, but that's what it took. It took what it took for me, and that's what it took for me. So hope that helps a little bit.
It does. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura G. Martha S.
Hi. Thank you, Larry, so much for your sharing today, and thank you, Leah, for your service. This is Martha S. in upstate New York. I was thinking about the whole recovered versus recovering thing. In my live meetings that I go to, we all say, I'm Martha, I'm a compulsive overeater. But with a year of being, feeling like I'm recovered and actively working or living in steps 10, 11, and 12 every day, I would love to say, hi, I'm Martha, I'm a recovered overeater, but I'm not sure if that's helpful to newcomers or helpful to the people in the meeting who've been in the program a long time and are having trouble maintaining their abstinence. But I think it might be good for people to hear that people are recovered, because when we say, I'm Martha, I'm a compulsive overeater, it kind of implies that I'm still struggling from day to day, and I don't feel that I am. I'm trudging the road of happy destiny, I'm doing the work, but I don't feel like I'm struggling. I'm wondering if you have an opinion on that you'd be willing to share. Thank you.
I do, Martha. Thanks for the question. You know, we're very, I don't know if the politically correct is, because it's recovering, you know, it's not like a swear word, right? But when I share that I'm, you know, in a face-to-face meeting, I'm Larry, recovered compulsive overeater, you know, I may disturb some people, you know, and that may be all to the good. It has proven that way for me. It's no longer about me and my own pride and my own, it's my ego that wanted to be perceived in a very nice way. I don't want to make any waves. Now, I don't come in there with ego. hey, yo, you know, I'm recovered and you're not. Drop the mic. You know what I mean? I mean, right? That's not happening either. I get the opportunity to say, you know, I'm a recovered compulsive reader. And, you know, let me tell you, you know, what that means to me, you know, that being recovered, obviously, I'm not cured of anything. I wouldn't be here if recovered meant cured. But, you know, in the big book, it talks about, you know, being recovered. And that's what my experience is today. And I just share them honestly. So I might have disturbed them, but I share honestly, you know, and usually we get an opportunity to do that or even after the meeting, that what that means to me today is that as a result of following these precise instructions in the big book, that I had some sort of psychic change. The big book talks about psychic change, personality change. They also use that synonymously with a spiritual awakening. And something happened to me to where that obsession was lifted. It was as though it was pulled right out of me. And I couldn't tell you a point in time when it was, but, you know, and see, my life today, can you imagine? Maybe you've experienced this too, I'll tell people, you know, but maybe they haven't. Can you imagine what it feels like to not have to be battling with the food every day, being out of the food? You might hear, and you know what I'm talking about because you've experienced this. When we are not battling with the, you know, it was harder when the food was down and I couldn't numb out from the stuff that happened in life. So when that obsession is lifted, now I have energy to be able to live my life and I have a design for living that works. I have a mechanisms in place within this program to, you know, see, the point is that it gives us the opportunity to explain what it means to us. And you know what? People can hear humility. Sometimes we can't define it, but we know it when we hear it. Because I got to tell you, I'll just leave it at this. If you liked anything that I said, and you know, I stole this from Leia. I use it all the time. She said to me, I was complimenting her. I think it was in a text, and she said, "Well, thank you for noticing God's handiwork." Now I'm putting the emphasis there because I picture Leia saying that. Thank you for noticing God's handiwork. But you know, you can hear humility. You know, giving credit to where credit is due. You know, you can hear your humility. Now, but if you hear that in my voice or someone else who's recovered today, you know, but you met me, let's say you met me and I'm 500 pounds. Well, something's not congruent there, right? The walk isn't matching the talk much. But if you talk about being recovered compulsive overeater and they see the humility, you know, and I work on that, talking about, you know, I'm a different person and share the humility of what this higher power, my own understanding, what this higher power has done for me. People do not, it's, you know, you don't get that big shotism. I hope I don't come across with that big shotism, like, look at me. Look at what I did for myself, you know. So I don't know if that helps a little bit, but I think over time I've talked about being recovered compulsive overeater in other meetings where it might not be used. And then it opens the door. It may disturb some people, which might speak more about where they are right now, which is fine. But then it also opens the door for opportunities to talk about just what that means to me. So I hope that helps a little bit anyway.
Yeah, thank you. That was very helpful.
Sure.
Thank you, Martha S. Maureen M., your turn.
Hi, good morning. My name's Maureen M. from New York. Sometimes I feel like a recovered compulsive disordered eater. And then other times I feel like, you know, am I just recovering? I mean, I know it's about 7 months now, and I went through the steps rather quickly with my sponsor. I think I'm really grateful for that. And I'm grateful for your service and your share, Gary and Leah. But sometimes I lose, you know, not lose it, but my willingness and my resistance is down. You know, I've had some experiences. My resistance is up, my willingness is down, because I've had a couple of experiences with trying to offer, working with people on the doctor's opinion, and, you know, I have the fantasy of how that's going to go, of course, and then there was the reality. And it was difficult. And I'm going to continue because I think that for me is the difference between being enthusiastic and enduring, remembering that there's someone out there who will be willing. I was willing. I was desperate enough. I was suicidal. I would have done anything my sponsor told me to do, and I did. Now she tells me to help people, and I'm having character defects just pop up like, poppies in a huge field, and I'm just forgetting that I'm a conduit, for which a higher power sends the strength and the energy that people need. And that's all. I don't know. I'm trying to find the balance between supporting someone but not supporting them too much and getting to the work, because I know for me, getting to the work was the key to balancing my emotions. Of course, I put down the food for 3 weeks before I even embarked on this. So that's where I'm at. I mean, I'm worried that, my strength and my belief in a higher power, sometimes my character defects are just taking some time to move through. And then I didn't do a 10th step yesterday, and I should have, and I isolated, and I kind of fell back into old patterns. So, am I recovering or am I recovered? Feeling recovered means I don't feel like that anymore. And that's my question. Am I going to feel like that sometimes and just pray? Thanks.
I think it's a good question. I'll go to the big book, when we completed this, the action steps, and we get, we're through step 9 and on into step 10, and it talks about, we read the promises, right? And let's be clear, they come, and again, we're in the chapter Into Action, and I'm reading right here, and it talks about that if we're painstaking about this phase of our development, we're going to be amazed for we're halfway through, as we're in step 9. That was the case for me. But what it goes on from there, it talks about knowing a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, we will know peace. Now, it talks a little bit more about, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. For me, and I guess that's where my thoughts go when you talk about this, when this happened to me at first, it was new. It was new. It was going to evolve. God was going to use me. Remember, the whole purpose here is to be of maximum service to God and to those about us. And what I have found is that by going through this process, the confidence that comes from my higher power, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. It has dissipated over time. It so has my interest in selfish things. More and more I gain interest in our fellows, but self-seeking will slip away, right? So what I would tell you is this process of the unfolding, this is just my experience, others can share with you theirs, but this process of the spiritual awakening that has happened for me continues to grow and expand and unfold. Remember, when we're now in steps 10, 11, and 12, it talks about, the maintenance and growth, because we have to remain in fit spiritual condition. But over time, I know in the beginning, I was so used to waiting for the shoe to drop. That's what I hear, sometimes with people, and I hear a little bit embedded in your question is, because we're so used to waiting for the shoe to drop, so we're is this just that? That's all the experiential evidence we've had up to that point, which is probably decades for many of us. So there's a fear, but that fear dissipates over time. And, so the notion of being recovered has some caveats, right? Has some caveats. It tells me, the big book instructs me very clearly in how to maintain and grow, which has been, you know, that's been so freely given to me. So I think what I've noticed is, I mean, if you think, you probably don't think much about it, but I just want to make the statement that I'm on the vision line and I do this service. You know, one, it's I love it, love doing it, right? But the other thing is that, it's just out of what a charitable person. Let me tell you something. I busted windshields and chewed people up and spit them out, okay? And so if some of you are still there, I'm not that same man anymore. But my point is that God has changed me. So I'm certainly motivated, but not out of fear, but I'm motivated out of just there's some force that pulls me into wanting to carry this message of hope to other people, because I've experienced such a dramatic change from one end of the spectrum to another. So I think over time you begin to grow in confidence, only a confidence that is provided by your higher power. And you begin to trust in that. And that happens over time, I think. At least that's been my experience. So I hope that helps with that.
Yes, it does. I get be patient.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you. Holly, yes?
And good morning. Thank you, Leah, for your service. Thank you, Larry, for sharing this morning. I have had a very interesting time since I've been with Vision for You. I still consider myself a newcomer, but not to OA. And I counted up recently. I've been in the doors in and out of OA since I was 16. That's about 35 years. And lots of discouragement. And decided to step out this week, and I went to a face-to-face and experienced the same thing. I get to work on this because I came with expectations. That's something else going on. But I wanted to ask you if you could, Larry, please speak to this idea that at this speaker meeting, it was shared that if a person has not put down the food by step 3, then they need to go back to step 2. And I'm not going to go on any further. Would you share your experience from the big book about that faulty message? And with that, I pass. Thank you.
Sure, you bet. Yeah, well, it is a faulty message. It's probably someone, and I don't stand in judgment of that person. I hope you don't hear that from me. I'm not in a position to judge anybody else. But if something doesn't coincide with what has gotten me well, which is these words in this text, then I question it. So, you know, if I hear that sort of thing, look, we don't have to go far in the big book to hear about the notion of putting our heroin down. I like to call it heroin. You probably get that picture because I like the message that sends me and others, you know. Talks about, for example, in the doctor's opinion, it says, of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures could be of maximum benefit. And that's just one. And there's other clear, concise messages in the big book that let us know, look, Larry, you know, your heroin has to be down. And sometimes when I tell people, I don't debate with anybody, I don't get in any of that. I just carry the message of truth that I hear in these printed pages. But sometimes, you know, I'll tell people if someone might talk to me and they're still playing. See, I remember what it's like to still dabble in my heroin, because I remember what it was like, and I hadn't. You know, they say step one, you know, it's the only step we have to take perfectly. Of course, human beings, there's nothing we can do perfectly. But the point is that I had to concede to my innermost self that I was a real compulsive reader. And in making that concession, you know, and, you know, the words were cheap. My words were cheap. It's my actions. If you're done and you put your heroin down, you put the syringe down, okay, you got a chance. But can you imagine if right now, wherever you are, I know like in the Chicago area, I think I'm safe in saying that somebody has just put their syringe down last night. They were doing, heroin's not hard to get from what I understand. In my field, I deal with people and, you know, it's not hard to get. Okay, so they have just made the decision. They've been persuaded. Maybe they overdosed and they just put their syringe down, right? They took the band off their arm. They put the syringe down. And maybe at some point they dry out and they are ready to crawl out of their skin. They may have hallucinations, sweating, vomiting, you know, all manner of just disgusting, you know, things that you can imagine. And I mean, you know, maybe beyond what we experience with food, but, you know, some of us have experienced pretty strong discomfort. And they have to, at this point, before they're presented with maybe a solution, if they're lucky enough, a solution in the 12 steps, which I believe, if you're a true addict, their brain has to be cleared before you can, these steps, these psychological measures can be of maximum service to them. And so you got to be freed from that physical craving. And so, yeah, my opinion is it's not, you know, like, oh, it's got to be down. It's got to be down. You got to be down. It's got to be down before. I'm not going to, you know, talk to you while you're still high, you know, about the steps. You're not going to have the clarity of mind. Oh, your IQ is 160. Great. You're a genius, but you're a high genius. So genius, get off the food, get off the heroin, and then we'll talk, you know. So that's kind of where I stand in there, and you know, I don't get into so much of a debate, but when I hear things that are, you know, this is again the watering down of the message and people playing telephone, and you know, they're just repeating something they heard, or they're coming up with other things that are do not coincide with what's in the text, and you know, it does more than a disservice. It actually is moving people, in some cases, towards a sure death. So anyways, I hope that helps a little bit.
Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. Maureen H.
Yes, hello. This is Maureen H.
Please go ahead with your question.
Okay. I think I'm kind of piggybacking on what you just shared, but I hear a lot of speakers on this line stress the racing against time and, you know, working quickly through the steps. And I get that intellectually, but that wasn't my experience. I feel like it took 3 years to put the food down, but I had worked the steps through the periods of, you know, picking up, putting down. And, you know, consequently, my sponsees do the same thing. Now, my sponsors always told me, hey, as long as you weren't food drunk while you were working your step four, you're fine. And at the end of the day, whatever you missed, you're going to get in your step 10, you know, 11 and 12. So I guess, what's your thought on that? And also, what do you do as a sponsor when you've got a sponsor who keeps picking up? Like, do you say, okay, go back to reading the doctor's opinion, go back to, like, what kind of assignment do you, or what, if any, do you do in that situation? Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. Look, see, to me, you know, there are some people, and again, I don't know, you know, your situation and so forth, but there are people that come to this program and they might be a higher bottom too, you know. And here would be the contrast. And this, I think it needs to be addressed because, you know, people get to this program at different levels. And can you imagine that some people that work this program, they're not compulsive readers too, you know, they food is, they may be like the heavy drinker, you know, and they try to utilize the steps and they're able to utilize the steps and have some effect to it. But see, here's what I deal with. There are people, see, I've been around for a little bit and I know people that have died in this disease. They're the heroin addict, right? So they're not, you know, like they're the person who, I've talked to people who are 80 pounds and they can't stop vomiting, right, in secret. I've talked to people who are 500, 600, 700 pounds, and you know, those people are going to be dead in short order. So this disease to me, is, yes, it's cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it will kill you. Now, will it kill everyone? Does everyone get here? Some people get here, and they're not physically dying yet. They may never physically die from this disease. They may not even be a compulsive overeater of the hopeless variety. It may be problematic for them. So I deal with it from the standpoint of this disease as a deadly killing disease. And I'll give you an example, you know, how I'm motivated that way. You know, I remember a guy, he's dead now, sad to say, but I remember a guy that used to come to meetings, meeting I used to go to, and he'd come with the oxygen. He was probably 500 pounds, and he was, you know, he was working on, and the guy was, he was under a doctor's care, and the guy was starting to, you know, follow a food plan suggested by his doctor, and he was, I think they were just, you know, kind of throwing the spaghetti on the wall to see what sticks, and so OA was another thing, and he was doing that and dabbling a bit in that, and he was also getting in the pool a little bit and moving around. And see, the thing about it is he's still dead. The guy's still dead. And I remember running into this guy, and I don't say this lightly, it's very sad, but I remember running into him. He had been gone from the meetings for a while, and I walked into a Walmart, and lo and behold, there he was. And he's a man younger than me. I'm 50, to give you some context. It's a guy younger than me. He was in like one of the scooters, right? You can picture it. Had his oxygen. So-and-so. And, you know, and he was, you know, yeah, how you doing? I haven't seen you. Well, good, good. Oh, that's great. You know, if you want to talk, I said, you know, I'm happy to, if you want to, you know, work the steps, anything. I should really call you. Yeah, but, you know, Larry, what I'm doing is, my doctor, I've been in the pool, and I've got this thing, and I'm working with my doctor, and I see a psychologist and all this. That's great, great, great. In the meantime, I had picked up a couple food items. He had some things, and he made a comment on one of my food items, one of my absent food items. Now I was then and am now about 5'10", to give you some context, 5'10", 170 pounds. I was never his size, but I was about 100 pounds heavier when I got here. But he was commenting on some food item or something. Oh, yeah, I heard that stuff's not good for you. My doctor's telling me to stay away from that. And I said, it wasn't, you know, I used some discretion. I'll call him Joe. I said, Joe, do you have any idea how absurd, and I didn't say this from anger. It wasn't. It was from a loving place, really and truly. I said, do you have any idea how absurd that sounds? I said, you're dying of this disease, buddy. You know, I said it with love and compassion as best I could. I knew it was in my heart. And he you know, he is dead today. And I'm sad. That's sad. So I really approach it there, you know. Yeah, the heroin has to be down to move on with this. I hope that helps. That's just my opinion.
Thank you, Maureen H. Thank you very much. Larry, I want to be respectful of your time. You want to take a couple more questions, or would you like
to
wrap up?
Well, I want to be respectful of your time, too.
Okay.
So we could take a couple more, sure.
Okay, let's do that. Okay, are there any other people who have questions for Larry this morning?
Kathy K.
Cassandra A.
Kathy K. Cassandra A. Did I hear another voice in there?
Yes, Donna.
I'm in the R in Oregon.
H.
I hear Oregon. Oregon, what's your name?
Mary Lee R.
Mary Lee R. Okay, you're going to need to speak up when it's your turn. And then I believe I heard another voice in there.
Linda H., California.
Linda H. Okay, we're going to go with that. We're going to go with Kathy K., Cassandra A., Mary Lee R., and Linda H. Okay, Kathy K., go right ahead.
Thank you, Leia, for your service, and thank you, Larry. It was great to hear you today. And I want to pose a question to you that I'm posed with often, and I'm not quite sure how to answer. So when I finish working with sponsees and they are recovered, they often wonder if they are recovered, because they, like me, they will have moments or even days when they are back in resentment or fear or self-pity. And so as a result of those experiences, they think, and I've thought this on occasion, perhaps we're not recovered. My understanding from the big book, when it speaks about step 10, I believe, it does say that when resentment or fear crop up, we take the following action. So I've been telling myself and others that if the compulsion has been removed and if you're working the steps on a daily basis, you are recovered. But I think on this line, we often give the impression that if we're recovered, we don't have those moments or days of despair. And I just thought I would invite you to speak about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy, for that question. Yeah, I would love to speak about that. Yeah, you're right on with that. In my experience, step 10, when we read about that, it tells us, you know, again, we know it, so we've completed the process. The obsession has been lifted, right? And there's more work. There's more work that needs to be done. We trudge this road. But even then in step 10, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it in front of me at the moment. I stepped outside. It's nice out here today. It says, it doesn't say, and I stress with people, it doesn't say, if these crop up, it says when these crop up, which of course, Kathy, as you know, that has the presumption that they're going to crop up. Now, let me speak from my own experience. So does fear, look, I got here with a diagnosed anxiety disorder. I still have that disorder. Okay. It didn't, life still happens. I could sit here all day long and tell you that well, listen, Kathy, you know, I have a genetic predisposition towards my limbic system is not as good as yours. And, you know, there's all that. And, you know, I don't get into the debate. Life still happens. I still, I had eye laser surgery a few years ago. Guess what? One of my eyes, I woke up yesterday morning. I went to go have an eye doctor's appointment. It almost went back to what it was like before. Am I recovered? Oh, indeed I am. I'm recovered today. Things come up. I can only imagine, I hate to pick on Leah, but I really respect Leah, so many people online. I can only imagine with all her children and all the goings on and this and that, yeah, I bet you some resentment, some fears, some self-seeking behavior, some self-centeredness may crop up. Even after 30-some years in program, isn't she, or, you know, she's been programmed longer than I have. I mean, you know, no, we can't have an experience outside a human experience. So, you know, the storm comes. It's either in your life now in some way, shape, or form. There's someone sick in your life. You have your own issues at times, or it's on its way. But so too is the ability to transcend that. I'm recovered today. The obsession has been lifted, but there was never a promise that my life would be perfect. That was my own, you know, my own ego that would suggest that really what I want is to experience no discomfort, but it comes. I'm in a physical body. It comes. My mother went through, you know, some major health issues. Yeah, there's some pain. My daughter just moved away down to Florida. I don't like that very much. So what I would say is that how do I know that I'm recovered today? I know that I'm recovered today. The obsession has been lifted. I have not found it necessary, not even close, no matter all whatever's going on, to pick up my binge substances. And somehow the progression of the spiritual awakening continues to evolve too. So these opportunities to turn my thoughts to someone else that could help, they come up. So what I would tell people is take it easy, chill out. You know, now, you know, if we don't do the things to remain in fit spiritual condition, you know, there's also a result there. But I think over time, I don't live in fear of that. I know that things can get tough, that the clouds can roll in. But I tell people, you can trust in the confidence that your higher power is giving you. And all you need to do now, and I assure them, is to proceed forward with living in steps 10, 11, and 12. To the best of your ability with where your awareness is now. Take it easy. That's what I tell people. So that I'll pass. Thanks for the question, Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy. And Cassandra A., questions, please? Go ahead.
Hi, this is Cassandra A. Hello?
Yep, your turn. Question,
okay.
Please.
Mm-hmm. All right. First of all, thank you, Larry, so much for your qualification. I really gained so much from it. And I feel like my question is basically going to be around the same topic as other people. So I'm on my sixth step right now, and I've been really struggling when I've gone through, like, certain major steps, like step four or step six right now. I have a tendency to pick up. I had like a binge last night and even around my step four. And after that, I got back. And it's just really been hard because I don't know if it's like I just need to start again from step one. I just finally told my sponsor, but I just been really struggling when I face these major steps or feelings come up that are major. Like I still don't have that sense. I don't know if it's supposed to be recovery or what, where I just get overwhelmed with the feelings, emotions, and I know I need to sit with the discomfort, but it's just been really tough. And I just, you know, it's almost, I don't know, I'm getting to the point, which that's why your qualification really resonated with me, because I'm doing the steps, but I'm almost starting to think maybe it's not for me because it's not working so much. And I finally got to a point where I realized I probably need to, that I am going to use my nutritionist plan. My sponsor basically suggested I don't need to measure and weigh, like I can just pray before I eat and I'll be fine and da-da-da. But I've been realizing, especially after my step four and like still like struggling to release the weight, I need to just pick a structured plan and just really weigh and measure. And I did have some hesitancy about surrounding it. But today's day one in terms of the new plan and everything. But I don't know what suggestions or advice you can offer, because I'm kind of like, at my wit's end with this thing. That's it.
Okay. Well, sure. I can just speak from my own experience. This is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease. It talks about that in the big book, right?
Yeah.
And, for me, I I don't know your experience, you know, but I can just share with you mine. I dabbled in the steps. Mostly what I wanted was to be able to have my cake and eat it too. You know, I wanted to be able to eat but be thin. I really had not experienced the sequential changes that are offered as a result of working these steps precisely. I never gave myself a chance. Maybe you have, but I could tell you that if someone would have approached me and raised those kind of rhetorical questions, I think I might have, knowing where I was at different times, I think I might have defended. I might have felt maybe a little less than, or, oh, man, and just maybe been discouraged. But really, this program was very simple. It was made for a guy like me. Just simple. Again, I was a math avoider. I was complexity, just scared the daylights out of me. It was very simple. I just needed to work the steps precisely. Look, if I'm in the food, if I'm dabbling in the food, you got to determine for yourself what your binge substances are. That's for sure. They may be different than mine. But you know what? I had to be rigorously honest with myself. And if I'm dabbling in my substance, just getting a little bit of heroin, just a little bit. I mean, come on, just a little bit. You know, then I'm still in step one. These steps for me, they may work for you. They've never worked for me. Not a true compulsive overeater, because I would not have the clarity of mind. I wouldn't be freed from the physical craving, from the allergy of the body would be, I would be triggering the allergy of the body. And then, of course, that whole cycle that they talk about in the doctor's opinion, I'd be off and running. And then, you know, because for me, it was all about getting, I pursued the Veruca. Remember Veruca in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory? That's the little girl, you know, who wanted an Oompa Loompa. Daddy, I want an Oompa Loompa. And you know when I want it, Daddy? I want it now. And that was how I approached it. I wanted to be able to have a little bit of heroin, to be thin. I wanted to change. I wanted to be able to treat people nicer. I didn't want to bust out windshields. I didn't want to chew up people and spit them out. I wanted to be closer with people when I wanted, on my terms. See, I was still, for me, and you may be different, but I was still self-centered to the extreme, and it would take this program of action, work precisely with the food down, conceding to my innermost self that I, yes, indeed, I was a true compulsive overeater. I understand the problem. I'm beginning to slowly understand the solution to the problem, and now I need to bring that solution to light by chopping my wood, working these steps. So I don't know if that resonates at all for you, but I hope that helps.
It does. But I'm just wondering, should I just take time away from the steps right now and just focus on just really following the food plan to the T and just making sure the food is down, or do I just keep continuing at this point?
Yeah, no. For me, if the syringe is out, I'm on step one. If the syringe is out now, if I don't know what heroin looks like. I don't know. Maybe it's heroin. Maybe it's not. Then I need to back up a little bit and get clear on what my heroin is. You know, I tell you this. No doctor, a doctor, a nutritionist. We do talk about those things, but I mean, they don't know what my heroin is. Necessarily, they might tell me what they think, but you know, for me, you know, some well-intentioned people might tell me, look, we're going to teach you how to moderate your heroin. We're going to teach you how to live a little better, so that you can live by just taking out the syringe a little bit every so often, and somehow you'll be able to deal with injecting, wrapping that band around your arm. That would never work for a guy like me. Now, if I wasn't a heroin addict, maybe I could get away with that, but I don't know about you, but I couldn't wrap that band around my hand, around my arm, and look for the vein in the dark and inject it, even just with a little bit, no matter how much someone told me that we can teach you how to moderate your heroin. So I don't know. That's about the best I can answer there. Hope it helps.
Thank you, Cassandra A. Mary Lee R. Mary Lee. There you are. Speak up, please.
For being a service layer, Larry, and everyone on the line. I have two questions and they've both been answered. So blessings and peace to everyone. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Mary Lee. Appreciate that. And our final question for this morning comes from Linda H.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for your service, Leah. It's wonderful to hear you on the line all the time, and I so appreciate your Larry giving this service to us. I think you might have already answered my question, but I don't want to take a chance on missing this opportunity. I've been in OA for 30-some years, been going in and out of different fellowships, and have lost and gained 50 pounds many times over. I'm now 67. I am at an unhealthy weight. And really, I mean, at my age, I need to be able to get rid of the excess weight. I'm not a binger. I think I've come to believe, like Charles said on one of the special editions, I eat too much. And so I do weigh and measure sometimes, you know, when I'm home. But I'm not a binger. And my brain, you talked about, you know, you can't trust your brain. My brain, the obsession that I have is the debate over what to eat, when to eat, how to eat. It seems like I want to change the plan all the time. And I'm definitely at the effect of mental obsession, and I want the brain to stop. I need to disengage my brain. I found Vision back in April, and I've been working the steps with several different sponsors. People kind of come and go, and I'm in the process of trying to find a new sponsor. But I'm not binging, but I do eat volume. So the answer to me is to, of course, weigh and measure. But I guess what I'm asking is, it's not so much the allergy of the body, or is it? And the second question is, how do I get to quiet the mind? Because it's the obsession that I need relief from. And with that, I'll pass. Thank you.
Sure. Well, again, I'm no guru on this stuff, that's for sure. I'm just a guy that's had this experience. Could be different than others, too. I had issues with quantity. I had issues with, you know, different alcoholic substances, if you will, heroin, if you will. I had to look at those underlying substances and get clear on what those were. But yeah, I had issues with quantity. Look, I could eat one apple just to use this as an example. And when I got done, even as a compulsive eater, I could eat one apple. And when I got done eating an apple, I did not, like, I was not driven to eat 10 more apples. Okay. But for me, for example, I never ate one, sugary dessert item, one Oreo, unless it was the last one in the bag. You know, I never had a reasonable portion of pizza. Okay, so was it Oreos and pizza? Was that my issue? No, I had to look at the underlying substances found in those in combination. For me, it was, certain things in combination. And yeah, those were, sure, I had a problem with quantities of ice cream and sugary dessert items and salty, savory, crunchy things, for sure. Okay, but this wasn't about food for me. Now, I don't know if you're a compulsive reader, but the Big Book helps you to determine that for yourself, whether someone's 16, 57, 87, 67, doesn't matter. You know, I think it still works today. You can step over to the nearest bakery or the nearest, bar, or and you can quickly determine, that for yourself. I think one of the troubling things sometimes for people is, I know for me, it may sound like you're a little bit like me, that I really can analyze something to death. Ultimately, I think I had to do, to the best of my ability, get clear on what my binge substances were, put those down entirely, and if I am a true compulsive overeater, and then embark on this practical program of action, even if I've dabbled in it, tried it different times, but work it precisely, end to end, in sequence, and then watch what the higher power of your understanding does for you in the way of effectuating change. Watch, I've seen people that, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I've seen people, oh my gosh, they've changed, profoundly changed, and they didn't think it was possible because here's the thing, we do not know what we do not know. We can't go where we haven't been. So we have to, on some level, I think we have to trust in the process, a process that's been here since this book was published in 1939, trust in the process. And I would say, when you do that and you chop your wood, eventually the oak will fall. But it won't be because you chop harder, faster. It's just following the process precisely, detaching from the outcome as best you can. And that leads into the obsession. Yeah, many of us are obsessive people by nature. I know I am. So the best I can do is to try my best each day to detach from outcome. And one of the ways I do that is to subject myself to these instructions and just work them to the best of my ability and then watch what happens. Because when it happens to you, I'll wrap up by saying, when it happens to you, oh my goodness, see, there's someone out there that needs to hear your message and only the way that you can deliver it based on your experience. And so you need to recover not just for you. If you are a true compulsive overeater or a true addict, we need to recover because then we can be of maximum service, to our Creator and to those about us. So I don't know if that's that helps a little bit, but I thank you for the question.
Thank you, Linda H.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Linda. And thanks to everybody who asked questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, Larry K., for your service to all of us this morning. We really appreciate it. I'm going to end the meeting from page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then.